Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
With Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to Unbelievable and episode 2 of our new big conversation series. I'm Justin Brierley, so glad you're here and looking forward to bringing you a very long anticipated conversation between Sir Roger Penrose and William Lane Craig on God and the Universe today. Today's episode is available on video, of course. You can watch it over at thebigconversation.show and see all the other episodes from this season and our first season. These high-quality video debates between leading atheist and Christian thinkers on some of the biggest questions in life. Our opening conversation for this season, of course, was Brett Weinstein. Einstein and Alistair McGrath, both videos of that proving popular too. And if you'd like a special bonus video from today's show that you won't find anywhere else of Sir Roger Penrose telling me and Bill about his groundbreaking work with Stephen Hawking on Big Bang singularity theorems, then do sign up to our newsletter too. Again, that's available at thebigconversation.show. Well, before we get into today's show, a reminder that The Big Conversation is coming to the west coast of the USA very soon. In fact, it's just 1 week away at the time of the release of this podcast. On Friday, the 11th of October in the evening, I'll be in Costa Mesa, California, and be joined on stage by Professor John Lennox and Dave Rubin, two leading cultural thinkers. So as we ask, is God dead? It's going to be a conversation on faith, culture, and the modern world. And then on Saturday, the 12th of October, Unbelievable, the Conference USA, John Lennox will be there, along with a team of Christian apologists from both the UK and the USA, including J. Warner Wallace, Mary Jo Sharp, and myself. And I've just organised an exciting last-minute addition to that lineup. I'll tell you more about that later on. But you can be there too. The tickets and the info at unbelievable.live. Don't leave it to the last minute, though. You will pay more on the door. So do book in now for Unbelievable live in LA or Costa Mesa at www.unbelievable.live. Right, no feedback on today's show as we're going long with today's conversation. But if you want to get in touch, you can find out ways to do so over our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, where you'll also find links to more resources, the Unbelievable book and the YouTube channel as well. But for now, here's The Big Conversation, Season 2, Episode 2. Hello, I'm Justin Brierley and welcome to Season 2 of The Big Conversation from Unbelievable, exploring faith, science, history and philosophy and asking what it means to be human. The Big Conversation is brought to you by Premier Christian Radio in partnership with the Templeton Religion Trust. And today, our big conversation is on the universe. How did it get here and why are we part of it? My conversation partners today are Roger Penrose and William Lane Craig. Sir Roger Penrose is a celebrated mathematical physicist. Among many accomplishments, he worked alongside Stephen Hawking to produce the Penrose-Hawking singularity theorems, which helped to confirm Big Bang cosmology. He's described himself as an atheist, but has rejected the idea that the universe is purposeless, saying, "I think that there is something much deeper about its existence, which we have very little inkling of at the moment." Professor William Lane Craig is a renowned Christian philosopher and the founder of Reasonable Faith, an organisation seeking to defend Christianity through reason and evidence. He's well known for arguments for the existence of God, such as the Kalam cosmological argument and the fine-tuning of the universe for life. He believes that God is the best explanation for the origins of the universe and why we find ourselves in it. So today we'll be looking at the deep mysteries of the universe and whether its complexity, order, origins, and the fact it produced us points beyond itself And if so, to what? So, Bill and Roger, welcome along to the programme.
Thank you.
It's great to have you both with me. I feel like a kid in a sweet shop, because having you both here is something of a dream come true for me.
Well, I want to say right at the beginning how acutely aware I am of the tremendous privilege of being on the same programme with one of the world's greatest cosmologists, and I feel honoured to be talking with Dr. Penrose today.
It's a huge pleasure and honour for me too, so...
Well, I'm glad that we're all in mutual agreement on these issues, at least, of how much we're glad to be here.
Something, yeah.
Let's see what we disagree on in the course of the programme. But let's have some introductions to you both. Roger, what drew you, first of all, to science and maths in particular as a young man?
I think it was largely my father, who has a great... I mean, he was a scientist, a human geneticist, mainly, medically trained, but also he philosophically and mathematically trained. So he had a good understanding of maths, and I think he had mainly it was a sort of playful understanding, like puzzles. He was a great chess problemist. Mm. And also, well, chess was big in the family. My younger brother became British chess champion 10 times, which was, of course...
tells me something about the way your brains are wired, perhaps, as well.
Well, it wasn't quite the same with all of us. But Oliver, my older brother, was also an excellent chess player, became a Cambridge University champion, for example.
There you go.
But I wasn't at all. I was not interested in chess. But I was very much interested in puzzles and games. Well... mathematical kinds of puzzles and also physical, geometrical puzzles and things like that. So that was an important feature of my upbringing, I think. But we used to go for long walks and looking at plants and talking about the universe in various ways.
Did faith ever feature in your childhood or not particularly?
I would say no, it didn't. In the sense of a particular religion, no. You see, my father came from a Quaker family, so he had that kind of background. But he had very much sort of sympathies with Quaker. He was very much a pacifist and that sort of thing. He didn't like conflict. But he wasn't a believer in the sense of... religious believer. Mm. He wasn't a Christian, certainly, nor was my mother. So that was not part of the family upbringing.
And did you ever have any brushes yourself with religion growing up or as a student?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, maybe at the age of 7 or 6 or something. I'm not sure we count that sort of thing. I'm not. No, I wouldn't even say that then either. I think there was a big question mark in what's going on, yes, but not...
I was going to say, I mean, as your scientific career progressed, did that open up any of those big questions about where did this all come from?
Well, there
from?
Was a curious thing. I remember at one time when we were in Canada during the war years, and we used to go every Sunday to Sunday school, you see. And I think my younger brother, Jonathan, asked the question, we were a bit suspicious that this is just a way of getting us out of the house so that they could have some peace, you see. And Jonathan asked my mother, she said, whether she really believed it, and she got this embarrassed look on her face. But this was apparently an indication that I don't think there was any confession to us that they hadn't actually been confident that this was... the truth. It was a way of having some peace during Sundays. Mm. And Jonathan sang in the choir.
Well,
I remember so that kind of aspect of things.
Has in a sense, has any of that filtered through to you in terms of at least appreciating the, often people talk about the majesty of choral singing?
At
Oxford University, where you have been based for a long time, there are beautiful chapels and services
no, I
available.
Think all that, it makes a huge impression on me, yes. And and music, I mean, well, I'm a tremendous fan of Bach, you see, and I think that there's, there's something absolutely incredible in the music, and I can understand. I mean, he was driven by his religious faith, Christianity, and obviously it was a hugely important thing, and the expression of that in music can be extremely moving.
Yeah.
We'll come back. I want to talk to you about your work with Stephen Hawking, obviously, and that will feed into what we're talking about on the show today. But let's introduce you, Bill, on the show. It's wonderful to have you here. I suppose in many ways, the sort of things that Roger has been working on throughout his life have been very influential in some of the important arguments you've been making for the existence of God. Because I think in the 1970s that you started to really engage with Big Bang cosmology and see that there was an interesting and fruitful relationship here with some other philosophical arguments.
Yes. Interestingly, my background sounds rather similar to Roger's in terms of my upbringing. I think you were actually more involved in church activities than I was. My parents were at best nominal Christians, but we never attended church. But when I became a teenager, I began to ask what I call the big questions in life. Who am I? Why am I here? What's the meaning of my existence? And as I looked at the universe, I could see no meaning to my existence. I knew that humanity would eventually perish in the heat death of the universe, and I could see no reason for its existence, for the existence of human beings, and in particular for my existence. And I simply faced an inevitable death in which I would cease to exist. And so, for me, it was these big, deep, existential, philosophical questions that eventually, through the witness of a girl who sat in front of me in my high school German class, led me to faith in Christ. And as a Christian, to finally get to your question, Justin, it's important for me to have a synoptic worldview. Mm. That is to say, a worldview that includes a Christian perspective on all of the different facets of human learning, whether it be the sciences, literature, art, psychology, history, philosophy, and the deep metaphysical questions. So you're correct. When I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the Kalam cosmological argument under John Hick at the University of Birmingham, one of the things I began to explore was whether there might not be some sort of scientific confirmation for the claim of the Kalam cosmological argument that the universe began to exist. And I was startled to see the degree to which contemporary astrophysics did support this premise, in no small part because of Professor Penrose's work on the singularity theorems. So that is an important part of my worldview as a Christian.
And hence why you've been engaging with Roger's work really a lot of your life. And I know that you yourself have had a number of discussions and dialogues with significant scientists and philosophers. It's obviously a hugely contested argument, but one that I think we'll get to some of the interesting aspects of it in the course of today's discussion. Thank you very much both for joining me on the show today. Roger, I said I wanted to ask you about Stephen Hawking, of course, who was a brilliant mind, a convinced atheist, though, and especially latterly, he came to believe that science had ruled God out, or at least as an explanation of the universe. How far did you agree with your former colleague on that?
Well, you see, there's a huge irony in all this, of course, which is my view about the origin of the universe. And I remember hearing there was a bit on the there was a new book of Stephen's posthumously
book, published,
yes, which and there's a chapter in which he talks about the origin and the Big Bang, and I thought it was the most unconvincing part of the whole thing. So well, you see, the huge irony here is that I've changed my mind on all this. So these singularity theorems were, as you described, these were confirmation of this singular origin. And the word singular has to be explained here. It means a place where, essentially, where your equations go to infinity and you have to give up. Or in other words, it's where your equations cease to work and they stop telling you what to do, if you like. And the idea is we take observations about the expansion of the universe and the equations of Einstein and try to extrapolate backwards and use general theorems which show that you really can't evade the singular origin. So that's where things, the equations blow up and you have to, you can't rely on the equations to give you any, tell you what happened at the beginning state. And Stephen has a particular way of looking at that, which was an interesting way. I don't think it works myself. He developed an idea with James Hartle, an American who in California, very interesting man, and I think the idea is a very interesting one. But I have some problems with it.
You have some major reservations.
Yes, but the main thing is that my current view is that the Big Bang, although it existed, there was a Big Bang, was not the beginning. Mm. And so that there was something prior to the Big Bang. But if you like, the reasons, original reasons for my thinking about this are a bit like the kind of thing you're talking about, you know, about what the universe is for, why, what's it doing, and kind of that kind of question. Mm. Shall I go into that?
Well, let's leave it for the moment, because I do want to go into where you are now with your cosmology, which is utterly fascinating and mind-bending at some level. But maybe we should start at a more sort of fundamental level, because I quoted in my introduction from a quote of yours. I'll read it out in full now. You say, there's a certain sense in which I would say the universe has a purpose. It's not there just somehow by chance. Some people take the view that the universe is simply there and it runs along. It's a bit as though it just sort of computes and we happen by accident to find ourselves in this thing. I don't think that's a very fruitful or helpful way of looking at the universe. I think there's something much deeper about it, about its existence, which we have very little inkling of at the moment. And you've obviously written as well at length and spoken of the fact that you see that there's a sort of three ways in which you can look at reality: the mental, the physical, the abstract. And in some sense, you actually believe there is more to this reality than simply the physical aspect, that many people, many of your atheist colleagues would say, well, that's all that ultimately exists here. Mm. Roger, do you want to just begin by sort of spelling that out, what your worldview is in that sense?
Well, you mentioned, when you say my worldview, you mentioned the three worlds, which I often use to describe. Like, these are things also, the three mysteries, if you like. Well, one of these, you say there's the physical world, you know, things like tables and so on, and what we think of as the physical world, although it's not quite clear when we go deeply into what's going on, what that really means, but never mind about that. The physical world, and then there's the mental world, that's our experiences, consciousness, feelings about things, so on. And then there's what you call the abstract world. I would be more specific about that. It's a mathematical abstraction. So we're thinking about how it is that... Well, let me secondly explain the mysteries, you see.
Go ahead.
Mystery number one is the fact that this world of physics seems to depend so extraordinarily precisely. And the more we explore it, the more precise we see this is. It's so precisely guided by mathematical equations. So we have these mathematical, let's not just say equations, that's a bit too specific, mathematical principles, which govern in such a precise way the way this physical world operates. And there is, if you like, a huge mystery. I'm calling it a mystery. These things, we're never quite sure whether...
is this what Eugene Wigner famously spoke as the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics? It just seems to be an extraordinarily remarkable fact that mathematics, that the universe seems to be written in that language and that we can discover it.
That's exactly it, yes. Mm. Yes. And the more we know about how things operate, I mean, now there's such extraordinary precision there are in measurements. Well, Einstein's general relativity is very, very precisely determined. And laws of quantum mechanics and how they interrelate with, even with gravity in some respects. I mean, how clocks... one of the Einstein's predictions is that a clock up high will run more slowly than one down here. And this precision in that... I'm sorry, I got it the wrong way around.
But I know what you mean, yes. The precision is extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah. But the precision, you know, even from down here to maybe a centimeter above, and they can measure the difference.
Yes.
So these are extraordinarily precise. Now, okay, it just shows that the mathematical theories, when we really understand them and when we get them right, they're still not quite right, well, that's clear. But nevertheless, the precision is extraordinary. So that's mystery number one. Mystery number two is, how is it that conscious experience can arise when the circumstances seem to be right? Now, it doesn't seem to be probably... I'm just guessing, but I don't think it's present in that glass or in the water in the glass. But nevertheless, it seems to come about with, certainly with human beings, and I think with other animals. I don't think it's unique to human
certain
beings.
Certain brain structures somehow seem to give rise to,
yes,
to this consciousness.
And there is a genuine mystery, I think, and it's not just a matter of, you know, complicated computations. There's something much more subtle going on. So that's mystery number two. And mystery number three is our ability to use our conscious understanding to comprehend mathematics and these very extraordinary and self-consistent but deep ideas, which are very far from our experiences. So that's the how we comprehend mathematics, if you
and,
like.
And in that sense, you believe that mathematics, for instance, is discovered rather than invented by
Absolutely.
Us. In that sense, it exists
yes.
independently.
Yes,
of
right.
Us.
Yes.
And one of those great mysteries, as you say, is the fact that we can access it. Seems
yes.
itself a remarkable feat of reality.
That's right, because it's so indirectly connected with our existence and what, you know, how we get along in the world and how natural selection has helped us to survive and so on. It's really hard to see how these things come about from
well,
that.
There's three big mysteries there to kick us off with. Bill, what's your response to some of these huge
well,
areas?
I want to say first and foremost that one of the most exciting things about Roger's thinking is this deep metaphysical vision of reality that he has. It's in such contrast to the sort of positivistic and verificationistic pronouncements of many scientists who think that philosophy is dead and that these metaphysical questions are meaningless. Mm-hmm. Roger is engaged in questions that are not simply physical or scientific. These are metaphysical questions. And I think that the fundamental issue that is raised by this tripartite metaphysics is the ancient philosophical problem of the one and the many. That is to say, what is the underlying unity of these three seemingly disparate realms of reality, the mental, the abstract, and the physical? These realms of reality are so different, so causally unconnected, it seems, that one wonders what is the underlying unity for all of these. So how are these three realms related? For example, the mathematical abstract realm cannot be the source of the physical or conscious mental realm, because abstract objects by definition are causally effete. That's part of what it means to be an abstract object. The number seven, for example, has no effect upon anything. So the abstract realm cannot provide the source of unity. Could it be the physical realm that provides the source? Well, Roger's already mentioned the second mystery. How does the physical give rise to consciousness, particularly intentionality? The intentionality is the aboutness of our mental states. I can think about my summer vacation. No physical object has intentionality. So the mental is difficult to derive from the physical, and the abstract, it seems to me, is impossible because the mathematical realm is characterized by necessity. These are logically necessary truths, and by its plenitude. There are infinite realms of mathematical objects. And the physical realm, by contrast, is contingent and therefore cannot ground these logical and mathematical truths, and it's plausibly finite as well. So the physical can't be the support. Now, what about the mental? Could the mental be the source of these other two realms? Well, in mental causation, we do have the experience of the mental causing physical changes in our brain. I can will to get up or to speak. Similarly, many philosophers have thought that the abstract realm is not really a separate realm that exists by itself, but they are ideas in the mind of consciousness, that they are the result of intellection by a mind. Now, the problem is that no human mind could be the source of the abstract realm because of its plenitude and necessity, whereas we are contingent and finite. So what I want to invite Roger to comment on is, why couldn't the mental realm include an infinite consciousness? That is to say, an omniscient mind which has created the physical realm and which is the source of the abstract mathematical realm. This would solve the problem of the one and the many and give you an underlying unity for this tripartite metaphysic that you affirm.
And what you've just described sounds suspiciously like God, Bill.
Yes, it did sound suspiciously like that, yes.
Roger, what do you say to that?
Well, you see, you're putting it as an interesting... you're putting it in the mental world, if you like, whereas I tend to put it in the Platonic mathematical world. You see, that I don't quite see why. I mean, how do you drive the precision? You see, just a mental thing doesn't seem to me. But I don't quite see why it helps, if you like. I mean, you can postulate a super mental being or something. I mean, does it have a mental existence without a physical one? Is that the idea?
Yes. Yes, and so this omniscient mind has created a contingent physical realm and is the source of the conceptual realm as well.
I can't quite see. Well, you could say that it contains all that because it's so infinite that it contains the entire mathematical world in a sense. But does it? Where does it come from? What's its?
Well, it would have to be metaphysically necessary in order to be the source of broadly logically necessary mathematical truths, and I would say other sorts of truths, ethical truths that are plausibly necessary.
Yes, it's very curious. You see, you have the mental world sort of being a necessary.
Right.
And I have the mathematical world somehow being a necessity because it's somehow mathematical truths somehow. Yes.
I appreciate the necessity, but the problem is that the abstract realm has no causal powers. These are causally effete objects that never come into contact with things physically. They can't move them or shove them or pull them. They exert no forces. They are not minds, and so they can't make decisions to cause things. They're not causal agents. So it seems to me that positing the abstract realm as fundamental is causally inadequate, and what one would gain from what I'm proposing would be a solution to these three mysteries. It would give explanatory depth to your worldview.
I don't quite see how it explains anything. I mean, does it? I mean, you're talking from a perspective of a religious person, and therefore one's thinking of this as somehow. I mean, specific religions are much more specific than
right, and that's why I grimaced a bit when you said from a religious perspective. Yes. It's a philosophical perspective, but
it is. I'm happier with that because then you see, this is what I have more trouble if one's trying to make it specific in certain directions, as regards one religion or another. But if it's just such an abstract notion, it's not that I'm necessarily unhappy with it, except that I don't know what to do with it because it's so vague.
You're listening to The Big Conversation from Unbelievable. Sir Roger Penrose and William Lane Craig debating God and the universe today. And we'll return again in a moment. Don't forget you can get access to more debates, updates and bonus content by subscribing at thebigconversation.show. The UK's leading faith debate show is coming to Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. Join me, Justin Brierley, for Unbelievable Live in LA on Friday the 11th and Saturday the 12th of October. On Friday night, I'll be joined by renowned Christian thinker Professor John Lennox and LA's leading secular talk show host Dave Rubin to debate God, faith, and atheism. Then Saturday is Unbelievable the Conference, a day to learn from Christian thinkers from the UK and USA on how to make the case for Christ, featuring J. Warner Wallace, Mary Jo Sharp, Brian Brodersen, and from the UK, John Lennox, Ruth Jackson, and me, your host, Justin Brierley. Book your place for the big conversation on faith this October at unbelievable.live.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to part two of today's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, bringing you the second in our new season of The Big Conversation. Today's topic, the universe. How did it get here and why are we part of it? Lots of anticipation for this one. In fact, I think William Lane Craig has already done a podcast about it ahead of time. I'm sure now it's available. It'll generate a lot of discussion too. Do check out the feedback already coming in under the video over at our YouTube channel. And do go to thebigconversation.show to subscribe and get that bonus video of Roger Penrose telling me and Bill about his groundbreaking work with Stephen Hawking on Big Bang singularity theorems. Well, let's join the conversation again now as Roger continues to unpack the three great mysteries of his worldview: the physical realm, the mental realm, and the abstract mathematical realm.
Just for my benefit,
yes.
This abstract realm of mathematical objects and so on.
Yes,
you say it's there. It's a mystery. Why it's there? How?
No,
it's there.
I wasn't calling that the mystery. Yes, see, the mysteries are the connections. I like to draw this picture with the three worlds. Yes. You see, the worlds are there. The mysteries are the connections between the worlds. So, mystery number one was how somehow out of a small part of this mathematical totality. We see physical laws, and it's only a very small part. I mean, you look at any old journal, pretty well mathematical journal, you see it's full of things. I'm talking about pure mathematics. Mm. It's full of things which certainly don't purport to have any connection whatsoever with the physical world. I mean, some of those seem to have, and it seems to be a very tiny part of that world, which has to do with the operation of the physical world. So that's one of the mysteries. And then the next mystery is why it is that a very small part of what we call the physical world, organized in just a very specific way, comes about very rarely. I mean, all these planets around, how many of them actually do we think has life of any sort in it? Conscious life? That's a huge question. Yeah. But anyway, whatever. It's a very tiny part of that which gives rise to mentality, as far as we can see. And then it's a very tiny part of our mentality. I mean, even mathematicians don't spend their whole time thinking about mathematics. They have other activities, which, you know, they go to the movies sometimes. They have a love life, some of them at least. And
so when Bill tries to solve that mystery by saying, well, what if there is an underlying explanation to it? It's all contained within a divine mind.
It's putting the divine mind in one of these worlds, you see, which I find a little bit. Yeah. I find that a little bit. Not just asymmetrical. I just find it not very explanatory. Put it like
why
that.
Not? Why do you find that this doesn't?
Well,
help,
you just say, oh, well, there is a super mentality, and it can do anything. I don't know. I would need to have more of an explanation about exactly.
Well, for example, take mystery number one: the applicability of mathematics. I think this is a huge issue because on Platonism, you have this abstract, atemporal, non-spatial realm of causally effete objects, and the physical world happens to operate according to certain mathematical principles that you've described. And as Mary Lang, who is a philosopher of mathematics at the University of Liverpool, has said, on Platonism, the applicability of mathematics to the physical world is a happy coincidence, which just seems incredible. By contrast, we know that minds can design things. And the view that there is an omniscient mind who has designed the physical world on the mathematical blueprint that it had in mind is a very ancient perspective that goes back to Middle Platonism and people like Philo of Alexandria, who said that the intelligible world, the intelligible cosmos, exists first in the mind of the logos, the divine intellect, and then is instantiated in the physical world by the logos who creates the world on this blueprint. And that seems to me to be a good solution to the one and the many problem.
The thing is that you call it a solution. My problem is it's too vague. I don't see how you can do much with this particular view. You see, we when it comes to the explanation of how a physical world operates in terms of mathematics, it's extraordinarily precise. Mm. And one can say an awful lot about that. But a statement like the one you make here worries me because it's, you know, you can call it a solution, but it doesn't tell us very much.
Well, it solves the mystery.
I don't even know why you say that.
Is it because it's very hard to then investigate this explanation itself, that
you'd
if you like, there's a mystery behind the mysteries?
You'd need to be able to say, how could you contradict such a view? You see, it's so vague in a way. I mean, why wasn't there a mind which was in some malicious? Well, maybe it is malicious. I don't know. We don't. It's just saying it's a mind without telling us.
Right. I haven't said anything about the moral properties of this intellect, but I would be prepared to. I mentioned earlier that among the logically necessary truths that this mind would know and ground would be not only mathematical truths, but certain ethical truths. Mm. I think certain ethical principles are not contingent, but are necessarily true. And so this would provide a grounding for the objectivity of moral values and duties in a paradigmatic good. This being would be not only the source of the mathematical realm, but of the ethical realm in being the supreme good. And so now we're beginning to add a little more content to this notion. As the creator of the physical realm, this mind would have to be uncaused, timeless, spaceless, immaterial, enormously powerful. In order to cause the ethical realm, it would have to be good, perfectly good, and to cause the mathematical realm, it would have to be omniscient. And so we're winding up, I think, with a very rich theological ultimate.
I mean, of course, you're touching on these other Platonic aspects, like morality,
that's right.
and you didn't refer to the beauty aspect of too.
Good point. Also, aesthetic values
so
as well.
So one has those three Platonic aspects, and one can extend the idea of the, well, truth, if you like, which is perhaps the mathematical part of the of the Platonic notions, and to other three as well, which I'm quite happy to consider. But I guess that my problem is that it's just, I said this before, it's just too vague to know what to do with it.
You can make
these words, you say, well, it does this and it does that, and
right.
It does that and explains this and that, but in a way which I don't quite
a scientist, let's say Bill has this hypothesis that God is the ultimate explanation and grounds these various phenomena that you believe in and you see. Is it that you find the hypothesis itself doesn't do it because you can't investigate that particular hypothesis?
I think that's the main problem I have with it. It's a bit hard to know what to do with it.
And inevitably goes beyond science in that sort
exactly.
of way.
I mean, we're doing metaphysics here, right. not physics. This is a metaphysical vision of reality consisting of a tripartite division of realms that have very mysterious interconnections. And so what I'm suggesting is a metaphysical hypothesis that will provide unity in the diversity and solves the one and the many. And I think it's pretty specific. I rattled off a number of the properties that this mind must possess, and that I think that's not...
Let me raise an issue with you then.
Yes.
Because if we're putting this thing in the mental world...
Yes.
Then to me that means it would be possible to be that thing. So that means one could be this entity, this God or whatever one calls it. And I find that really hard to perceive. I mean, somehow with a being of this sort with this kind of total control over the whole thing. I mean, it's so much at odds with my own, well, certainly experiences of what conscious experience is, that I don't quite see.
Do you believe
to call
in
it
free
a conscious
will?
Thing.
Do you believe we have free will?
I think there is something there which is not explained by. But I mean, this is it goes into some technical issues here about the operation of the world and where our understanding of physics might have a gap in it, and so on. Mm. And maybe one could call that a free will. I would maintain an open mind when it comes to that question.
Well, then, if this being has elected to create agents with freedom of the will, then it's not true that it's in control of everything.
Does the being have the will, have the freedom not to to have all this?
Well,
could it not do that somehow?
I think that that's a further question to be explored. It would seem to me that as the creator of the physical realm, it would be very easy for this mind to have created a world with no free moral agents in it, a world in which the highest form of life is, say, rabbits, and there wouldn't be any free will. But if
I don't know, maybe rabbits do. I'm not sure about that.
Well,
one.
However that may be, if this being has elected to create significant moral agents that are endowed with freedom of the will, then it means that not everything that happens is controlled by this being in a marionette sort of fashion. Mm. And that would gel, I think, nicely with our experience. I think that this gels with our experiences of beauty, of ethical norms and obligations that press upon us, and with respect to our own freedom to transcend the physical realm and not be simply determined. So this really fits beautifully with our experience, I think.
What would it take, I suppose I'd be interested to know, Roger, what would it take to move you from acknowledging the mystery and the depth of what is the reality we live in to acknowledging a source of the sort that Bill is pointing to?
I just don't see why it's a solution to these problems. I think that's my real issue. I mean, it's you can postulate that there is some kind of a thing which one could call a god, I suppose, and that thing is supposed to inhabit this world, which is the mental world. To me, that's a hypothesis which I can't quite see what to do with. Hmm. I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong. I just can't see why one should attribute this thing, which is somehow the answer to all questions, should inhabit the world of the.
It sounds like you'd rather have the questions than put that sort of an explanation to the questions.
Yes, I think, I mean, there could be a truth in such a view, but I don't see why I'm driven to believe that. And I don't see why it should be a conscious thing. You see, this is, I mean, could be. I'm not saying I deny it.
Okay.
I just don't see the explanation, why this explains very much. To say that this entity, godlike entity, whatever it is something with a consciousness of its own. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong, and it might be that there is such a thing. Maybe one, you know, like in some religious views, after death, somehow one's consciousness becomes part of that thing. I'm not saying I think that's a wrong view. I don't necessarily think it's a wrong view.
Let's have one response, yes. And then we'll move on to some of the specifics of cosmology here.
I'm not trying to drive anyone to a conclusion. I'm offering a metaphysical solution to what you admit are profound mysteries in your own worldview, where we have these three disparate realms of reality that don't seem to connect very well. And given that you've already got the mental realm, you've already got the realm of mind. It's a small step to postulate an omniscient mind.
But why don't we, you see, we've already got the physical world, you see. You could say, why don't we put it there?
Well,
we've got
I already
the mathematical
spoke to
world.
That.
Why don't we put it there?
Right. I already spoke to that because you can't put it in the abstract realm because that realm is causally effete. You can't put it in the physical realm because the physical realm is contingent and finite, and therefore cannot explain the logically necessary and infinite abstract realm, and it's very difficult to explain the mental realm too on the basis of purely physical causes.
But I think you're just saying it's not here and it's not there. It doesn't mean it's in the third place. It might not be anywhere.
Well, no. I mean, if there are these three realms of reality, and the unity, the underlying unity, can't be found in two, it follows logically that it's going to be found in the third unless there is no unity to be found at all.
Well, maybe the unity is something much deeper than any of these pictures.
Well, then you're...
It's contained, it has to do more with the totality of all three. In some sense, rather than putting it in the mental world.
Yeah.
So putting it in the mental world is giving it degrading it in a way. I think that's what I feel about it.
It feels unbalanced to you
in some
way. Yes,
it's imbalanced, and if it has free will and somehow, then that's somehow degrading it because it says it could somehow have done something else. It's like us. It's too much like us. It's too much like putting like old ancient views the Greek views of the gods in some sense. They were too much like us.
But they were finite. Contingent. Here we're talking about a metaphysically necessary source of the Platonic realm and the physical world.
Perhaps significantly, the Judeo-Christian traditions, of course, do speak of humanity being made in the image of God.
I think that's the kind of thing I'm having trouble with.
Well, it's been a fascinating conversation already, gentlemen. I've really enjoyed it. Why don't we move to one of these specific worlds, the physical world?
That's the one I'm happy. No, that, I'm not sure.
Because obviously we're titling this discussion "The Universe: How Did It Get Here, and Why Are We Part of It?" Let's talk about the fact that we know now things we never could have dreamed knowing 100 years ago about the nature of the universe we live in. It must have been an extraordinarily exciting time when you were developing those theorems with Stephen Hawking and seeing them confirming what has already obviously been meeting you from the observational evidence of the Big Bang, the background microwave radiation and so on. Can you just describe a little bit what it felt like in those, very significant years?
Well, you see, there's an evolution of my thinking in
of course,
this, which
yes.
changed. You see, how do I start? I mean, really, my entry into this was more from the gravitational collapse, black holes and things like that. And there was this argument. I mean, we knew that there were these solutions of the Einstein equations which tell you have a collapse. This was the Oppenheimer-Schneider model just before the war, 1939, when Oppenheimer and Schneider, Schneider was a student of Oppenheimer's. Oppenheimer, of course, was famous for the atomic bomb and work during the war. He was in control of that project. But he did this work, which the only thing I know that he did on general relativity was this model of a collapsing body. And the thing was, in this solution, the material fell inwards. It was what they called dust, means it didn't have any pressure. So this material fell inwards, nothing to stop it, and it was completely symmetrical, so it fell right in towards the center, and therefore the density became infinite, and then you got stuck, because what happens? Singularity. Mm. Things go infinite. But the question was whether that was really what happened, because it could be a little bit irregular. It wouldn't focus in this middle point. It might have pressure. It wouldn't be necessarily this dust stuff. Much more realistic. Now, what happens in realistic solutions? And this was interesting because it was in 1962, I think, when quasars were discovered, and these objects which seemed to be hard to explain unless they were concentrations of material which would be of the nature of this thing that Oppenheimer and Schneider had discussed. And the question is, was it real? Were these singular states? And then the comparison with the Big Bang was made. You have this singularity in the collapse and the singularity in the expansion, which Lemaître and people
had already postulated.
Einstein produces equations, and then Friedman and Lemaître and people had actually shown this. You get these solutions where you get this singular origin. Einstein didn't like the idea at all originally, but then he got persuaded, and then it was the observations of the expansion of the universe which suggested maybe it was really like that. And then this view of the Big Bang. But is, again, you see, is this a very specific thing which only happens with this really great symmetry and very particular kind of material, or is it generic?
Yes.
And I studied the collapse situation, and came across, well, there was some Russian work which seemed to indicate it was it was not generic, and that turned out to be a mistake. There was a mistake in their calculations. But I was able to produce a general type of argument which showed that the collapse, you couldn't get away from it. It really did produce a singularity. And then Stephen Hawking picked up on this and applied it to cosmological situations and showed that the singularity, and then we got together and had a paper which we wrote on this. But it showed that the singularities, that is to say these places where everything seemed to go infinite and equations went all wrong, was a generic phenomenon. This has been there for a long time, and I began to worry, well, you know, people study about the models of the universe, and they were always only studying the one where Lemaître, the very symmetrical universe models, where you didn't even need these singular theorems, if you like, because they were looking at the cases where we're completely symmetrical, at least in idealization. And it worried me, why are they so different? That is to say, the singularity in the Big Bang, when you look at what happens in the collapse case, completely different. I mean, the similarity was what sort of started this off. But when you look at it in detail, it's completely different. Now, this has to do with this fundamental principle of physics known as the second law of thermodynamics. Now, the second law of thermodynamics tells us, roughly speaking, that things get more and more randomized as time goes on. There's a thing called entropy, which is a measure of this randomization. And so this is the general principle. It's a very fundamental principle of physics, and it's all over the place.
Yeah.
And you see this in these singularities. The Big Bang, with this very, very special, idealized singularity, and in the black holes, it's almost completely the opposite. The low entropy beginning and the high entropy singular states.
Incredible order in the beginning, rather than
this
incredible
very order.
Diffuse
entropy. And the nature of that order seemed to be in paradox with the the observations of the cosmic microwave background. This is the early observations of radiation coming in all directions. This is microwave radiation, like in your microwave oven.
Yes.
and this radiation seemed to be very uniform over the sky. Not only that, it had a spectrum, that is the frequencies at different, the intensities of different frequencies were such that it showed that there was this maximum entropy state, highest randomization you could have. So it was completely randomized, but yet it had to be ordered. Yes. And so I puzzled about this for a long, long time. And you have this order. The explanation is, and I think it's more or less accepted now, is that the explanation is that the order is in gravity and not in anything else. So you have this very, very gravitationally ordered structure, that is to say the gravitational degrees of freedom did not take part in this thermalization. Everything else, all the photons, all the matter, everything else was randomized, but not gravity.
Right.
And this struck me as a huge paradox. How do you have this imbalance between one and the other? And that had been sort of in the background for a long time of my thinking. Now, there was a particular moment, perhaps I should describe this.
Go ahead.
Where I was, I mean, it's a bit like the questions you raise, you see, where I was thinking about the future of the universe. And what we come to understand in recent years is that there are these black holes. Not only are they there, but they're absolutely huge ones. Our galaxy, in the middle of our galaxy, is a black hole which is about 4 million times the mass of the sun. And it's just there, and you can see the stars going around. I mean, you can measure them in real time, in movie of the stars going around. And then there's something in the middle there.
Is this the one that was even imaged recently?
That was not the
same.
It was sort of put out that it was going to be that one, but the image they showed was a different galaxy with a much, much bigger black hole.
Okay.
So I think I can't remember how much bigger it is than this one, a lot, lot bigger. So you see these huge black holes in the centers of galaxies. Mm. Now, what's going to happen? Well, they'll start swallowing up more and more of the material. Some of it will escape, but maybe about half. I don't know what the figures are exactly. Will get swallowed up. Now, in a cluster of galaxies, you get... many. We're in a cluster. It's only got about three or four. I can't remember how many. The biggest one is the Andromeda Galaxy, and we are on a collision course with the Andromeda Galaxy. It'll take a few thousand million years before we encounter it, but then the black holes will feel each other out. They will collide, swallow each other up. It will be mainly the one that swallows us up. And when I say us, I mean our black hole.
Right.
And the material in the cluster... most of it will get swallowed up eventually. You get much bigger clusters, then most of the material gets swallowed up. And so it's a pretty boring state because you just got these black holes sitting there and most of the matter's all swallowed up. Pretty boring. And then I thought, well, it's not... There's thing interesting that's happened because Stephen Hawking explained, this is his greatest contribution, it's a very important thing, that the black holes are not entirely black. They have a very, very... They're pretty black. Pretty damn black. But they have a very, very low temperature. But over the years and years and years, not thousands, not millions, zillions.
Trillions, zillions.
You have to think in terms of googols. If right. So that's 10 to the 100. 10, think of one followed by 100 zeros.
Yeah.
That number of zeros. Mm. Probably more with the really big ones.
Mm.
And... after that period of time, the radiation from these black holes will take all the energy away and energy away, and then disappear with a little pop. When I say pop, okay, nuclear explosion or something, depends on how you measure it, it doesn't matter too much. Anyway, they disappear. We just had this very boring era when we had the boring time when the black holes were the most exciting things around. Then it got really deadly boring.
And this is what you've described as the heat death of the universe in that sense.
Yes,
you
I see, think so.
It's the cold death of the universe. Yeah,
well,
you see, it's the heat.
Thermodynamic death.
Yes. Yes. It's right. It is. I don't know.
But whatever it is, it's a very boring
unbelievably
nothing,
boring.
Nothing of any interest exists this point.
So I got depressed by this, you see. Naturally. Why should I be depressed by this exciting universe that we live in? And that's this interminable tedium.
That's what we're in for. What's the point of all that then?
Exactly. Yes. And that's your sort of question. But then I thought...
it's worse... I don't know if it's worse than tedium, but I mean, we won't be there to experience it. It's not as though it's boring. It extinguishes.
Yes, but let me go on, that's the key point you're making.
Yes, to the new
You're making a key point. We won't be there, but who will be there? Photons, mainly. Now, you see, it's very hard to bore a photon. Not just because photons, I don't think, have experiences, but that they don't actually, if I could use the experience again, a word perhaps inappropriate sense, they don't experience the passage of time. So time does not, it's the way relativity works. Mm. The time from the creation of that photon to infinity is nothing.
As far as that photon's concerned.
That's right. Yes. It has no, as a clock, it doesn't have any
this
time
is because
experience.
It doesn't have any mass, essentially.
That's
and
right.
For something to act as a clock, it has to have mass. It but at the point mass. Where you've got no mass in the universe,
exactly. That's
it's
right.
just photons, then you've got no time, essentially.
There's no time. And if there's no time, there is no measure of space either, because how space is measured now is in terms of time. How long does it take light to get from here to here, that distance... is a time, and that the measures of distance are in terms of times. So that's the way physics is understood, and that's the way distances are measured. The meter rod in Paris is no good as a thing anymore. But if you were a meter,
right.
you define it in terms of light and how long it takes light to go from here to there, and how far that is. So if you don't have any measure of time, you don't have any measure of scale. And that means that big and small are equivalent. So in this remote future, distances become irrelevant, and times, you have to understand a bit more of the details, which I can't go into here,
of course.
but it's what's called a conformal picture. What's quite useful to think of, many of our listeners might have seen some of these Escher pictures, the things called circle limits. You can have this angels and devils interlocked. It's a nice thing from the point of view of a little joke, I think. Escher likes these little jokes. And you have these angels and devils, and they get more and more crowded along to the boundary of this thing, and they get extraordinarily precisely done, right up to the boundary. And that's the infinity of the world that these beings inhabit. But nevertheless, you can see it as a finite boundary. And it's a conformal map. They're squashed this way as much as that way. Mm-hmm. And in space-time, it means the time and space are squashed by the same amount. So that the future bound, the infinity is somewhere. That's the point I'm making. There is actually a place, or a time, I should say, which is the infinity. And if you were massless, you'd get there. It's just like the angels and devils, that the boundary of this Escher picture is a thing which is there. Even though it represents the infinity of that world, it's there still.
Yes.
And you could imagine a continuation to something on the other side. And the picture I have, which is put forward, I don't know, about 15 years ago, not many people paid any attention to it, is that there was something on the other side. There is to be something on the other side, and that is the Big Bang of a subsequent eon.
Right.
And similarly, our Big Bang was the continuation of the remote future of a previous eon. The word eon now. Mm. I looked up in the dictionary to make sure that the word eon didn't mean a definite number of years. So I'm using it now.
It just means an unimaginably vast period
of
time.
You're listening to The Big Conversation from Unbelievable. Sir Roger Penrose and William Lane Craig debating God and the universe today. We'll return again to their conversation shortly. If you want to send in feedback, feel free to send me an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or let me know what you think via social media. That's @UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the show page over on Facebook. If you like this show and the videos we're producing, don't forget you'll never miss a thing if you download our Unbelievable app, and you'll get access to more debates, updates and the bonus content by subscribing to the newsletter over at thebigconversation.show. We'll see you very shortly.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the final part of today's show, Unbelievable, bringing you episode 2 of our new season of The Big Conversation. And we'll return shortly to the final part of that conversation on God and the universe between my guests William Lane Craig and Sir Roger Penrose. If you're listening via radio, up next it's The Profile. The evangelist and church leader Gavin Calver will be talking to Sam Hales about his newly appointed role as head of the Evangelical Alliance here in the UK. And The Profile's available on its own podcast too. Next week on the show, I'll be out in California, of course, for Unbelievable Live, but we've got a great edition of the show coming up nevertheless. Steve Chalk, well known as a church leader in the UK, who's taken some controversial positions on issues like sexuality and atonement. Well, now he's back with a new book, The Lost Message of Paul, and he says we've got lots about the apostle and what he taught wrong. Well, he'll be debating it with church leader Phil Moore. You may remember Phil came on to debate feminism and the Me Too movement back at the start of the year. Well, let me tell you now, we've already recorded this one, and boy, it is a feisty debate. Maybe too feisty at times. Anyway, you'll be able to watch that on video too. That's next week's show. Make sure you don't miss it by subscribing to our podcast, to the app, and of course the newsletter too, over at premierchristianradio.com. chess.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to the next big conversation in California as well, coming very, very soon. John Lennox and Dave Rubin in what is looking like another highly anticipated conversation. You can be there too, asking questions as part of a live studio audience edition of the show on Friday, the 11th of October. It's going to be so good. Really looking forward to that one. And why not get the combo ticket and make a day of it the following day at Unbelievable, the conference on Saturday, the 12th of October. We've just released the schedule recently. Got some fantastic sessions coming up. John Lennox on changing the culture, living like Daniel in Babylon today. Mary Jo Sharp and Jay Warner Wallace both telling their story of how they changed their mind from being an atheist to a Christian. Really interesting journeys they've been on. Brian Broderson of Calvary Chapel on Jesus, the ultimate game changer. And tons of afternoon seminars as well, where we can go into real depth on the issues on the front line of culture with John Lennox, the front line of science with AJ Roberts, the front line of youth work with Ruth Jackson. And I'll be there to talk about my story, the story of the show, and why after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. You can get signed copies of the book there at the conference too. Mary Jo Sharp and Jay Warner Wallace on deconversion and doubt and making the case for Christ, the resurrection. Plus lots of chances to interact with people via the Q&A for each seminar and a big panel discussion that rounds off the day. I did say we've got a special news of an extra guest joining us, and that is none other than Bobby Conway, also known as the 1 Minute Apologist. He'll be coming along to the conference, and we'll make sure he's included as well in some of the seminars and the Q&As going on. So look out for Bobby as well at this year's Unbelievable Live in LA, or Costa Mesa, really, on Saturday the 12th of October. It's going to be a really big weekend with those two events. So this is your last call for the USA this coming weekend, Friday the 11th and Saturday the 12th of October at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. Go online, get your tickets at unbelievable.live. Okay, back to the final part of the big conversation between cosmologist Sir Roger Penrose and philosopher William Lane Craig, as Roger outlines his own unique CCC view of the universe.
And this is what you've called the conformal cyclical cosmology. And
yes.
And in that sense, it shouldn't be confused with, but it sounds a little bit like the sort of bang crunch idea of that was in fashion at one time.
Yes.
But this is actually a sequential series of bangs.
Right. There is no collapse, you see. It's different.
Yes.
I mean, that's right. They're one of the Friedman models, right, early after Einstein produced his equations, had a universe that expanded out and collapsed. And then it could bounce and have another.
But this is essentially a continually expanding universe.
It never collapses.
But at the point where time sort of becomes irrelevant, it's almost indistinguishable from the Big Bang, where time is also...
That's right.
We can't
and you might say, aren't they very different? Because the Big Bang is hot and dense, very concentrated and extremely hot, whereas the remote future is extremely cold and rarefied. But you see, when you lose the scale, it applies to the mass, it applies to temperature, if you like. So you squash, when you squash down, the temperature goes up. When you stretch out, it goes down. And they're completely equivalent.
Well, I want to return to this. It's a fascinating idea. Before we do that, Bill, let's talk briefly, first of all, about your work with the Kalam cosmological argument, which has been... very much focused on Big Bang cosmology as it's been traditionally understood up till now. And if you like, Roger's thesis is something of an extension of that. But your view has been that actually what we do know of cosmology, what appears to be verified from science, supports this idea that the universe had a beginning, mm-hmm. That there was a cause to the universe, and philosophically we can speak of that cause being God.
Yes, this is a very ancient argument for a creator that goes back to the attempt of early philosophers to rebut Aristotle's doctrine of the eternity of the universe. And during the Middle Ages, it was developed in great detail by medieval Islamic philosophers and then mediated through Jewish philosophers back into the Latin-speaking West, and finally came to be enshrined in the thesis of the first antinomy of Immanuel Kant concerning time. And it basically goes like this. It's a very simple argument. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Secondly, the universe began to exist, and then the conclusion follows, therefore the universe has a cause. And in support of that second premise, that the universe began to exist, the medieval proponents of the argument appealed primarily to philosophical problems with the infinitude of the past. And they raised a number of, I think, very cogent objections to the notion of the finitude of the past. But now with the advent of modern cosmology, we seem to have pretty dramatic empirical evidence in support of the second premise as well, so that the premise, I think, is more probable than not, both in light of philosophical argument and scientific evidence.
And that's where a lot of your discussions have ranged around, you know, whether if there is a beginning to the universe, if there is a sort of a boundary, if you like, to time and so on, whether we can speak of a cause of that universe coming into existence and whether that cause could be God.
Yes, though the question of the beginning of time is a subsequent question to the beginning of the universe. I think that time is a metaphysical quantity that is different than our measures of time. The fact that a photon doesn't measure the passage of time, I think, is irrelevant to the fact that the photon exists in time. I agree that with Newton on this respect, that time itself is a metaphysical reality, and what physics discusses, physical time, is our best attempts to provide some measure of this time. And these measures may be accurate or inaccurate, affected by gravitational fields, affected by uniform motion, and so forth. But time itself is not something that is a physical quantity. It is a metaphysical reality.
Do you want to respond to that?
I'm having trouble with that. I mean, the view we have in relativity is certainly we don't have a time in the sense that we talk about time in normal language, because it doesn't run the same for everybody, if you like. Mm. I mean, we these experiments with clocks and different
relative.
Places.
That's our measures of time. Our measurements are affected by motion.
I don't know that I've understood what you're saying exactly, but it's as though somehow there is a time in the sense which progresses universally. Is that
yes,
right. You see, that's certainly
so. For example, these photons in the far distant future, these photons in the far distant future are temporally later than the photons that exist now. Indeed, some of them may have had emission events in the past. Well, if they have a past and they're in the future, they're clearly in time.
No,
even
I don't
if
agree.
A photon itself.
Nope, I'm not agreeing with you.
You don't agree with that, though.
No. You see, it's suggesting there is a kind of, you know, time progressing or independent. No, you can have a temporal order without having a time associated with that. And if you have distant events, then they go according to a different. They may have a, which is earlier or later. For a particular thing, which is earlier or later in an event on the Andromeda Galaxy, you see, for example, depends on if I start moving forwards, it's not different from when I move backwards. So, and it, by weeks probably. So, how does one? Do you say that there is somehow a universal concept of time?
I would be a Lorentzian with respect to that. I think, as a number of other contemporary physicists.
When you say a Lorentzian, you mean
H. A. Lorentz?
Yes, I'm not quite sure what is technical. When you say that,
that there are relations of absolute simultaneity in the world, even if our measuring devices are affected by uniform motion in the typical relativistic way.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I'm disagreeing with that.
You're disagreeing with that. Sure. I mean, we're probably not going to get to the bottom of this. But
could I raise an issue that I think is more fundamental?
Okay.
I noticed that when you spoke of these symmetrical predictions of a singularity and your work in showing that even in a universe that is not isotropic and homogeneous, that this singularity would occur.
Yes.
You spoke of whether or not they were realistic solutions or not. And I think this is one of the fundamental questions to ask about your conformal cyclical cosmology. To what degree do you think this is a realistic depiction of the universe as opposed to a mathematical model. I notice in 2006 you said, so far we regard the conformal space-time prior to the Big Bang as a mathematical fiction. However, my outrageous proposal is to take this mathematical fiction seriously as something physically real. Now, I'm suspicious of that outrageous move.
Well, you see, I use the word outrageous as a defense against people who would be saying, that's an outrageous idea.
Yes, yes.
I already said that.
Yes, you admit it.
Because it's outrageous in the sense that it's very different from the conventional view.
Yes.
I don't think it's outrageous. In fact, if you ask me now what I think about it, I think it's correct. I think that there is sufficient evidence now, this is very different from those days, sufficient evidence now to indicate that it makes predictions which are not made by the conventional view, and we actually are beginning to see are actually present in the observations. Now, this is pretty new. There are things which are a few years old which had to do with signals. You see, I had this view, you're going back to whenever it was, 2006 or something.
Yes.
When there was no observational indication of this particular view, apart from, okay, it seemed to make sense of certain things which were puzzles, which other schemes don't seem to make sense of. I mean, I think I mentioned earlier in the fact that the gravitational degrees of freedom are highly suppressed in the early universe, whereas the others are not. In this scheme, that is explained, whereas in other models of the universe, inflationary cosmology and so on, I don't see an explanation. So, but that's not the point I'm making here. These are subsequent... Yeah, I mean, I used to give lectures on this, taking the view that you more or less described, that this is an interesting idea. Nobody will ever know whether it's right or not. I'll be able to go on giving lectures on this till the end of my time, at least, without contradiction. But then I started to think, well, maybe there are observational tests. And I began to worry about what is the most violent possible thing apart from the Big Bang itself. And I was thinking about, okay, I mentioned our collision with the Andromeda Galaxy, which will take place eventually, and our black holes, which will feed each other out, and eventually they will swallow each other up, and there will be one fantastically huge emission of energy in a form that we might not even feel if we were present at that time, in the form of gravitational waves, but an absolutely enormous release of energy. And that enormous release of energy will spread out through the universe, but would be detectable in principle by beings in the succeeding eon. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm claiming that these things happened in the eon prior to ours, and that the signals produced by these collisions between supermassive black holes, these signals are actually observed. And with an Armenian colleague, Vahi Gurzajan, I wrote an article on this, a paper quite independent of ours by some Polish colleagues headed by Christoph Meisner, and a more recent paper that they did on, this was originally on this satellite which was called the WMAP satellite, which was looking at the microwave background, and then the more refined observations of the Planck satellite were analyzed by this Polish group later on, and they found that with a confidence of 99.4% these signals were real and not artificial random.
So you think there's been physical confirmation in that sense of the cyclical model?
And the newer observations are the things which I call Hawking points.
Well, let's not get into too much more detail there. But Bill, let's say, you know, that possibly this model could be a potential sort of way of understanding the universe. I suppose one question I have is, would that mean it is infinite into the past? And would that mean that you kind of avoid the need for a divine sort of starting point or anything
like
that?
Well, I can't resist saying first that the observational data is underdeterminative. The majority of cosmologists don't explain the data through this particular model.
I agree.
I mean, most cosmologists, as I understand it from my reading, don't think that the entropy ever will disappear the way that this model requires. And they don't think that particle physicists don't think that electrons will decay, so that there will never be just photons. So
I don't think they decay either. So that's
but you do think they all disappear, right?
No. The mass, sure, the view is not currently accepted by modern cosmologists, and I agree with that. Mm. But they haven't looked. I have never had any explanation of, let's take the Polish work, because they're more explicit about the probabilities there. The Polish work, I haven't seen anybody contradict what they've done. I haven't seen any answer to this probability confidence level of 99.4. Now, this paper was only came out earlier this year. But there was an earlier paper they had, and there's an earlier paper we had, I haven't heard anybody say there's anything wrong with it.
Mm-hmm. But the point was that the data is underdeterminative. You said that it was 99% sure that the signals were real, right? But the question is, how do you best explain this imprint?
Yes, I would like to see another one.
I haven't seen one.
My bigger question, as it were, about this is I suppose it's the question. Let's say that we are living in this CCC model.
Sure, I think you're right. We should be talking about
exactly. The fundamental, perhaps most obvious question is, well, if that is the case, where did it come from? Why is there a universe at all? Whatever particular sort of, you know, reality it takes. Bill, I suppose for you, the Big Bang cosmology and so on has served to reinforce that idea of the idea that there is a mind behind the universe, that there is a cause.
Yes.
Would the cyclical model sort of, if it were in any way shown to be a good representation of reality, undermine the idea that we have to have a cause behind the universe?
Well, it doesn't show that the past is infinite. It only talks about two eons. I'm skeptical, again, that it's proper to speak of this other universes existing temporally prior to ours, because if time disappears, then they're not temporally related. You can't say that one is earlier than
and
later. Can
I interject here something? You see, when you say time disappears, it doesn't... order doesn't disappear. That is, temporal order does not disappear. See, I think there's a misunderstanding here. If the time, the notion of the length of time may be not preserved in a sense, but necessarily, but time order, whether something was before or after, still is preserved in the sense of causal relationships. And that's not affected by the conformal maps. Mm-hmm. So you can squash time or stretch it, but which is earlier than which is earlier and which is later is still preserved.
So you're talking about the metric of time.
Yes, that's right.
As opposed to temporal order of earlier than and
that's
later
right.
than. Okay, that's
exactly.
That's clear.
Okay.
Yes.
How does that play in as far as you're concerned to your overall picture of the idea of the universe being caused?
Yes, well,
by
the
God.
Question would be, can it be extended to past infinity?
Yes.
Or not. That would be the question.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, as you say, there could have been a first 73 time. If you go back, then that was the first one, you see.
You see.
It's interesting because I actually talked about this in the meeting in the Vatican a few years ago. I can't remember who it was exactly. And they came up with what I thought was, from their point of view, the correct answer. Namely that, suppose this infinite succession of eons is the correct explanation of the physical world. God created the whole lot, and that it's the temporal order of these things was not the important point.
Yes,
and I thought, yes, that's from your perspective, that's the right answer.
Mm-hmm. Is that satisfactory to you?
Well, that would be a different form of the cosmological argument, such as was defended by Leibniz. Leibniz held that even if you have an eternal universe in the past, that doesn't explain why there is any universe rather than
nothing. Why is there something rather than nothing?
Right. Yeah. And so for Leibniz, the eternality or infinitude of the past was irrelevant to the question of whether there is a metaphysically necessary being that explains why the universe exists. But this would be relevant, though, to the Kalam cosmological argument, because if it turned out to be correct and could be extended to past infinity, then it would not be true, at least scientifically, that you can give good evidence that the universe began to exist. You would still have all of the philosophical arguments in place against an infinite regress of these sorts of eons.
Obviously, we don't have time to play out in detail the argument as to whether we can establish, you know, that particular model. But there is an aspect of it that I'd love to dig into in the final time we have together, gentlemen, which is why this particular universe and the way in which it appears to be governed by these fundamental constants and forces that seem incredibly fine-tuned to allow for the existence of life to appear at some point. This is often called the fine-tuning of the universe for life. Bill, do you want to very briefly explain from your perspective why you see this as an interesting argument for the existence of God?
Well, in the contemporary literature on fine-tuning, there are basically three explanatory options. Either physical necessity, that these constants and quantities must have the values they do, that it's not contingent, or secondly, chance, and the form that this normally takes would be a kind of multiverse hypothesis, and then an appeal to an observer selection, self-selection effect, that we can only observe universes that are finely tuned for our existence, so we shouldn't be surprised that somewhere in the infinite multiverse that we should appear in such a universe. And then the third one would be design, that there is an intelligence that has designed the universe. And Roger's a special contribution, I think, to this has been to place a very significant objection and question mark behind the explanation of the multiverse hypothesis with the self-selection effect. Because if we were just a random member of a multiverse, we ought to be observing a much different universe than we do.
I want to come to that. I mean, first of all, on this question of fine-tuning, which, again, we might be worth just spelling out a little bit for the audience.
Yes.
You've yourself have contributed, interestingly, to this. There's a certain aspect of reality, the initial low entropy distribution of mass and energy. Now,
yes.
Without getting too technical at this point, this is essentially the idea you were sort of alluding to earlier, that at that very earliest moment, that singularity in Big Bang cosmology, there's an incredible amount of order versus the disorder, the entropy that appears later on, that needs to be there in order for a life-sustaining universe to be possible. In fact, you put this extraordinary number on it of the precision needed to be 1 in 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 123, which I'm told is, if you were to try to write that down there, and you put a zero on every single particle in the observable universe, you still wouldn't have enough zeros.
Nowhere
on this.
Close.
And so...
Yes.
This is mind-boggling stuff, but it appears as though someone, as you know, who was it who said that someone's been monkeying with the physics? Fred Hoyle said, it looks as though, as Bill has said, some sort of design is there to ensure that we got here. Now, what do you say to that idea?
Well, I'm agnostic, I would say, on that one. You see, it's not clear to me. I mean, people talk about the mass ratio between the proton and the neutron, and the fact that the neutron is just a little bit more massive than the proton, and it decays that way rather than the other way around, and so on. But it's very difficult to, since we only know one kind of life, you see, or one kind of the production of consciousness, it may be very rare throughout the universe. The numbers may not all be all that good, you see. You can imagine fiddling with them so that there were consciousnesses all over the place, you see. I don't know, you see. We don't know enough about that. And there are some nice examples from science fiction which show different alternatives. I like the one, Fred Hoyle's idea of the black cloud, you see, where this was a completely different way of imagining a conscious being,
okay,
which was this huge cosmic cloud which communicated, I guess, by electromagnetic signals and things like this. The other story which I like to refer to is one by Robert Forward, which was a Dragon's Egg, I think was the name of the story, where there was a neutron star which came close to the sun, and the people on the Earth went to explore it, and it turned out that there were living beings on this neutron star, which instead of using chemistry, they used nuclear processes. Mm. And this means that their lives and evolution took place millions of times faster than us. Mm. And how you can make a story with this complete imbalance was an amazing achievement, I thought. But they even had a religion which took place in the Chilas, which were the inhabitants of this neutron star. And when the Earth was thing came close to them, they built their complete religion on the star, which appeared, you see, in the
so
in
do
the
you
sky
think it's I mean, these are obviously stories, but do you think it's possible in a sense that some sort of conscious reality could exist even in the absence of the physical sort of carbon-based life that we obviously need?
It could have been done very differently, in a different, totally different. You see, there are many different parts of the universe where the physics is very different from what it is on the Earth, and maybe a different kind of life could have evolved there, and I have no idea. Mm. I just that we don't know. There are puzzles,
right,
which look like coincidental things. And they were, one of the first ones was Hoyle's thing about the energy level of carbon, which hadn't been there. Then you couldn't have got beyond evolution. Well,
Bill, what's your response to these sorts of ways of dealing with the fine-tuning?
Well, this is fascinating to me because, as I understand you, Roger, you're not advocating either physical necessity nor chance via the multiverse hypothesis and self-selection effect, nor design, but rather you would simply deny the fact of fine-tuning altogether, that the universe is not fine-tuned for embodied consciousness.
I think deny is too strong. I say I don't know.
You don't know.
Yeah.
And to me, that is highly implausible. We just find example after example of fine-tuning in contemporary physics, and it seems to me to be a desperate expedient to deny that it exists. In the absence of fine-tuning, there wouldn't even be matter. There wouldn't be chemistry. So the idea that other forms of life would evolve, I think, is logically possible, but it's not, I think, the most plausible solution to the problem.
Well, I mean, we just know so little about what constitutes life. Mm-hmm. And how it, I mean, we have the universe we have, and you could imagine fiddling with the numbers and making them, to what extent that freedom is even there, mathematically, isn't clear. I think we just know. I mean, I can see the arguments, and I can see there's a case for the arguments to say that, okay, from certain points of view, it looks as though there are accidental things about the constants of nature which have allowed things to happen, which if they hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here. And that's true. But maybe some other thing would be here which could have. It's not at all clear to me.
I was wondering whether the conformal cyclical model in any way sort of does the job of a multiverse, in as much as, well, if the universe has sort of had these rebirths time and time and time again, perhaps we're living in the one that was habitable for human life.
That's a possibility, yes. You see, there could be an evolution of constants. I mean, this was an idea that John Wheeler put forward, not with this model, but with other models, with the sort of bouncing universe models, that maybe each time there was a new set of constants produced and they were different each time, and we happened to be living in the particular eon, if I could use that word here, in which the constants happened to suit the kind of life, at least, that we experience.
So that's potentially a solution. Well, what do you think, Bill?
That solution seems to me to fall prey to the very argument that you give against using the anthropic principle with respect to the multiverse, because what you've done in trying to push the conformal cyclical model to past infinity is, in effect, establish a multiverse, except it's sequentially ordered rather than simultaneous. And in that case, then the question is, why do we observe a fine-tuned universe like this instead of the one which is unfathomably more probable, that is, say, no larger than our solar system, a patch of order that is that big. That would be unfathomably more probable than a fine-tuned universe. And indeed, maybe we're all just Boltzmann brains with illusions, illusions of the external world around us. Why? It falls prey to this very objection that you've raised.
No, it's an answer. You see, I'm not giving this answer because I don't like it.
Okay. So this isn't your favorite.
It's not my favorite, but it is a possible answer.
Right.
That the eons are different, that the numbers differ. They can't differ by very much from observational point of view. But they, I mean, some of them don't differ by very much. But they could differ, and they could evolve.
Yes.
It's certainly possible.
But
I don't like it, but it's a possibility.
Right, but then it doesn't explain our...
Yes, it does.
Observations, because the most probable observable universes are not
the one we
like
are
this one,
in.
A no, fine-tuned no, one like
but
this.
But I mean, we use the other argument. You say that we happen to be in the one where they are nice. You know, okay, there are the eons went this, and then one every 5 million or so maybe has nice conditions in it. And, sure, I mean, that's an excellent. I don't like it, but it's an answer to this question.
I mean... In a sense, you've said from the outset, though, that you're agnostic, essentially, on this whole question of the fine-tuning. You acknowledge that we do appear to live in a universe that is finely tuned for life to at some point develop. But you're at this point, you don't think we have any adequate
I don't think
way
the
of explaining
is
that.
Is that convincing?
Okay.
Because we don't even know... what constraints there are and what these numbers could be from theoretical reasons. Right. There might be... It's a big question mark. But a possible answer to the question, I don't quite see why you're objecting to this, would be that every so often in these succession of eons, the numbers come out right for life to work, and we happen to be in one of these because we have to be in those because we can't be in the dead ones.
Well, but we can be in observable universes that are not finely tuned for our existence, and those are in fact unfathomably more probable. You yourself in your work have said that the odds of our solar system falling together by the random collision of particles is around 10^10^60.
Oh,
which is utter chicken feed.
That part of it is completely explained by the model. That's not the point. I thought you were talking about small effects about depends on life may depend on certain chemical processes.
No, what I'm saying is that appealing to an observer self-selection effect isn't sufficient to explain why we observe a finely tuned universe.
No, but if you're calling the one part in 10^10^124, whatever it is, I mean that is perfectly explained by the model. That's not a question.
How do you mean it's perfectly explained by the model?
Oh, no, the CCC model gives you that.
Right.
Yes. No. That number I'm not taking as a question.
No, I was using that as an illustration of the fact that an observer self-selection effect isn't sufficient to explain why we observe a finely tuned universe. And there are a multitude of other finely tuned constants.
Yes,
and
but
quantities.
I want to know, you see, which finely tuned you're talking about. If we're talking about the 10^10^124 rather than 3 because of the dark matter, but never mind.
Okay.
Doesn't matter too much, even though it's a huge
it's
difference.
It's still a huge number.
Yes. That number, is a huge puzzle. That's one of the reasons for CCC.
Yes.
That's not. I'm not including that.
Right. We don't need to include that. That was just an illustration.
That's done, you see.
Yes, I understand.
Okay, nobody believes me, but I'm saying the scheme is done, yes. Yes.
That, nonetheless, there are other aspects of that appear to be finely tuned, that even which the CCC model wouldn't directly explain, only in this sense of we happen to live in the eon in which potentially this particular...
Although the question is, it takes a different form, you see.
Right.
You might argue that you have a propagation. There is a kind of instability. Some of these numbers mean that the evolution goes away and you don't have a nice continuing eons which were similar to each other. So there are different questions that could be raised on this point.
It's probably time to start drawing our conversation to a close. It's been utterly fascinating and I've so enjoyed
indeed.
It. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Perhaps start with you, Roger. I sort of hinted at this at the beginning, but Is there anything that would sort of cause you to cross the line from mystery to perhaps there really is a divine mind behind all this incredible order, complexity, and, you know, the unfathomable uniqueness of who we are in this universe?
Gosh. Well, you know, I mean, somebody could, you know, some divine thing could appear and and I could have a vision of something or other. But then you say, would I trust that?
Well, quite.
I'm not sure whether that would convince me about that. I mean, you see, it's not quite, it's more, I think it's more, could one twist the views about what I think? You see, I don't have a clear view about an overarching picture of what's really going on in all this. And I do say, okay, maybe there's, I talk about the three mysteries of connecting the worlds, but there's a bigger mystery, which is what on earth the whole thing all about, you see. And it's just that I'm not disagreeing with you in a way on that question, but I'm not quite sure to say there's a sort of mind which is supposed to answer these questions. It's really an answer to it. I don't find that satisfying.
I mean, your colleague Hawking was certain at the time he passed away that there would be nothing on the other side to greet him. I mean, if it were the case that you found that there was a divine mind,
put it like that. If there was somebody on the other side to greet me when I reach my end, I don't believe that experiences can continue. You see, because one's memories, you see, one's experiences involve one's memories and all that stuff, and I can't imagine coming as some other being later and having the same experiences as I've had and so on. That doesn't quite make sense to me. But whether experience in some abstract sense can continue is another question.
Right. And you're open to that possibility, or you haven't closed that off?
No, I haven't closed off any of these things. I just haven't the foggiest idea.
Bill, what's your thoughts as we draw this conversation to a close?
Well, I suppose my overall impression would be that theism provides a kind of metaphysical, fundamental unity to the world that is absent in the absence of the existence of a creator and designer of the universe and a source of moral goodness. The theistic hypothesis has a tremendous unifying force to making sense of reality, and therefore I think deserves serious consideration by any thinking person today.
Well, Roger and Bill, thank you so much for joining me on the program today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Great pleasure. Yes.
Well, I hope you enjoyed episode 2 of The Big Conversation from Unbelievable. What an absolute pleasure it was to be joined by two such renowned thinkers. I just love getting to make these unique conversations happen. And thank you so much for listening as well, and the support of the Templeton Religion Trust in making it possible. You can watch their conversation in glorious Technicolor 2 over at thebigconversation.show. Do subscribe there for a bonus video of Roger Penrose telling me and Bill about his own groundbreaking work with Stephen Hawking on Big Bang singularity theorems. Our next episode of The Big Conversation drops in 3 weeks' time on Friday, the 25th of October. It's going to be Bart Ehrman, the noted New Testament critic, with evangelical Bible scholar Peter J. Williams as they debate Jesus and the Gospels. That will be another unmissable edition of The Big Conversation from Unbelievable. But for all your other Unbelievable needs, do go to our show page, where you can find links to our YouTube channel, the blog, the Unbelievable book, the app, the ways to give and support the show, and of course our live events too. And I hope that if you're out in the US, you can join me for Unbelievable live in LA with John Lennox this coming weekend, the 11th and 12th of October, California. I'm on my way. I will see you there, but don't book in too late. Get the online price now for your tickets over at unbelievable.live. Well, the profile is here next, here on Premier Christian Radio. Let me tell you what's coming up on the show next week.
You're unbelievable.
It's Steve Chalk versus Phil Moore as we debate the Apostle Paul and what he actually taught. His theology, a new book from Steve Chalk, The Lost Message of Paul, is another one that's going to cause some controversy from Steve, who's already a pretty controversial character in some ways. Well, he'll be in conversation with church leader Phil Moore, who disagrees on pretty much everything Steve's written in this book. And you'll hear their very feisty conversation on next week's edition of the show. You can catch it on podcast as well, and it'll be available from our YouTube channel. For now, thanks for listening to the show, and see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.